Actor Richard Jenkins discusses his latest film, Let Me In, which releases on DVD and Blu-ray February 1st.
When you saw the final cut, did anything about it surprise you?
I loved it. I mean, I don't like watching myself on film. That doesn't thrill me. And so, but I did go to the premiere, and I really liked it. I thought that performances he got out of Cody and Chloe were just fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought they were fabulous. I thought it was really human. I said before, I think my favorite scene in the movie is the scene when he takes her to the arcade. Mm-hmm. And they're just two kids. I mean, I forget she was a vampire.
An interview with Oscar-nominated actor Richard Jenkins, coming soon on Movie Geeks United.
Okay, good. I was getting worried there, man. You know, I mean,
man, we're having the switchboard is freezing up. We're having these problems, but we're here. Okay, good.
All right, this is good. Welcome back, everyone. Happy New Year. We're very happy. We have a big year for you. We have a very big year for you. It's going to begin and end and continue with a bang, I'm under the impression.
Yes.
And the reason I say that is because, like, looking ahead at the movies of the year, every month there's, like, the possibility of some potential really good movies. And we're going to end the year with, we're going to have two movies from David Gordon Green. We're going to have a big David Fincher film again at the end of the year. It's shaping up just to be incredible.
We're going to have our 2011 movie forecast show on Sunday, January 23rd.
Okay.
So we can start writing this stuff down now.
Yeah.
I started writing it out today. This Sunday will be our top 10 of 2010 show.
Yeah, I mean, this is just such a good year for movies.
You think so?
Yes, I do. I honestly do. I think this is not as good as 2007, but it's close for me at least. I saw a lot more to like than dislike. Now,
yeah.
Not to say there are some high-level disappointments and just some really god-awful movies, though. There are a lot of really bad movies that you're surprised that gets a theatrical release, and some of the really good ones never see the light of day in the theater. But there are some high-profile disappointments this year, and that was true last year, too. But there are just some real gems this year.
Yeah, I think it's been. I think I know why our switchboard is freezing up. I just went to Facebook and I got a pop-up virus.
Oh God! Yeah. Well, that's Facebook. Yeah. Yeah, that happens. Unfortunately, no. There's something. Facebook has become like MySpace in the sense that there's just tons of spam and viruses around. So.
Yeah. Well, I just won $1,000 according to the pop-up. So.
Well, you go for it.
They could buy me a new virus-free computer. And then what else is going on? And then January 30th, that Sunday, the following Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
This is so confusing. I'm getting cross-eyed here.
I bet you are, man.
It's our Oscar prediction show. Because the nominations are announced the Tuesday,
The
25th, right. So and then we already have a show that Wednesday with guests.
Like that's a bad thing.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which guest yet for the 26th show, but I'm pretty sure included in that will be Margot Kidder. And then And then we'll have Richard Jenkins from Let Me In on February 2nd.
Okay.
See, I'm working this all out in my mind, and I'm involving the audience with this conversation.
I know, you're beginning to be seeing how Jamie DeVal's mind works, yes.
They're part of this. They're part of this process.
Yes.
So, okay, you have some nominations outside of the Oscars coming up.
Which, you could say are the precursors. Why don't we start with the Directors Guild? Let me see what I have here. Darren Aronofsky for Black Swan, David Fincher for The Social Network, Tom Hooper for The King's Speech, Christopher Nolan, Inception, and David O. Russell, The Fighter. And a lot of people have pointed out that the Coens got snubbed for True Grit.
Right.
I can't argue with anyone who's up there, though.
Who do you think took their place?
There's some talk that O'Russell took their place. I don't know. There's also talk. I figured Tom Hooper is going to get nominated for The King's Speech. This is, if anything can be said about this year, Harvey Weinstein is back, if he was last year, but certainly this year in full force. There's no way The King's Speech was not going to get this. He's really, I think, in overtime, and he's enjoying himself quite a bit. There seems to be talk of O'Russell. Here's the problem. All five directors are worthy of this, and yes, the Coen brothers are just as worthy, too. It's like picking, the Coen brothers have probably made one of their best films.
You think so?
I think it's up there. I don't think it's. I don't like it as much as No Country for Old Men or Fargo, but I do think it's up there. I have to say this about the film. I think it is every bit as good as the John Wayne film, if not better. I would actually say if there was a way to merge the two to have John Wayne in this one, it would be. I would put one of the greatest films of recent times. Because her performance is just astounding, and Matt Damon is superb in this. I think it's actually one of my favorite.
Matt Damon.
But it's a great film. It is a really incredible film.
Well,
so having said that, now what do you think about this?
I wasn't crazy about it, but
well, that's all right. I mean, it wasn't something I got. I must tell you, this I was not. You know, when I first heard about this, it was just to me, okay, they're going to try the Lady Killers route again? That's the first thing I thought of. And I was like, another remake? Are you really sure? But it's much better than I ever thought it would be.
It was one of the, two movies I was most looking forward to this year.
Okay.
That and Inception. And for me, True Grit, really, outside of the ending, didn't have any real discernible Coen Brothers flair for me. It seemed like a very authentic but middle-of-the-road kind of Western to me.
Well, it was a very old-fashioned Western. As I think Aaron pointed out on one of his many status updates, there was no irony. It's not it's a very old-fashioned film.
Yeah, and so when you go to the Coen Brothers movie to see something that that has very little trace of the Coen Brothers, what's the point?
there's here and there, but I don't mind. I didn't mind it. It was nice, to see that they sort of because look, they had all their quirks and everything on display for A Serious Man, and that didn't really go over well with people.
Yeah, do they care about that?
No, but I mean, that really, you talk about all the things that, are in a Coen Brothers film, and it's there in that last film. And that really didn't go over with, a good chunk of their fans really were turned off by that film.
Right.
I'm
sure they made the film they wanted to make. So
yeah.
I don't think they thought, man, we got to do something commercial.
No.
After Serious Man. But
no,
I prefer the original.
Really? I like
and
this
actually,
one just as much. I think, but and that's really her performance. But I also like it because of the Barry Pepper's character, and quite a difference between watching that and then watching Casino Jack the next day with Barry Pepper. Different performance, but I was really like that because you're going in thinking of one thing, and then halfway through you're like, oh wow, this is turning into quite something else. And I liked his performance. Jeff Bridges, I thought, was kind of doing the retread of Crazy Heart in many ways. But I was really in Matt Damon's character. I thought like he was really good. But I know what you're saying. It is an old-fashioned film, and I realize if you're going in, you know, you do realize, okay, the Coen brothers, well, this doesn't have a lot of their standard stuff. They are, like, toning it down, dialing it back, if you were. But it's I'm curious now because it's like it is their highest-grossing film.
Yeah, and the highest-grossing Western ever.
Yeah, so.
Yeah, but that's just it. I didn't see the Coen brothers in that. I didn't see a point in remaking it because they didn't bring anything new outside of the ending. Almost scene for scene, and much of the dialogue is identical to the original, which is identical to the book.
Right. No, that's all right. Having
and
said
I prefer
that,
I prefer the ending of the original too.
Okay. Having said that, though, what did you think of the remake of 310 to Yuma?
I didn't see the original, so I can't compare.
It's I like what they did. I actually prefer that because you couldn't make the original today. There's just some things, but what always struck me about that, it's a very good film, really punctuated by Ben Foster's performance. What really stood out to me is there's a scene in there, the dinner sequence in the first third of the film is like line for line, like almost camera angle, everything straight from the original. And I guess that's the closest we have sort of to an old-fashioned Western in this day and age. But I'm slowly getting used to these remakes. These are two I thought were just as good as the original.
Right.
But
it's
immaculately made.
Immaculately made. It's got great performances across the board. I mean, it's a stellar production. But even when they said why they made it, they said they wanted to bring it closer to the book. With the ending of it, because the ending's the one thing that's different from the original, and they knew that when they made it now, they could make it bloodier and more violent. And I'm like, really? Is that enough reason to go about?
Yeah, well, if that's a reason, I'm not sure about that. But it was much better than I thought it would be.
But I guess it can be considered closer, truer to the book, which I'm sure it is, because when John Wayne does a movie, it becomes a John Wayne movie.
Right.
And this is True Grit, you know, the Coen brothers.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about True Grit.
Right, right.
The property.
Okay. All right, yeah. I mean, no, you're absolutely right. John Wayne. I don't know. I have mixed feelings on John Wayne. I always have. I always will. So I like the Westerns and war films I could live without.
So, cinematographers.
Cinematographers, yes. We've interviewed some of these guys. Let me see. We got, for Black Swan, Matthew, and I'll let you pronounce his last name so I don't insult him.
Libatek.
Thank you. Inception, Wally Pfister. King's
Pfister?
Speech.
I don't even know her.
King's Speech.
Here
Danny Cohen. The Social Network, Jeff Cronenweth. And True Grit, Roger Dinkins.
Wow.
That's,
what do you think?
I think Matthew's going to get it. I think Matthew or Wally, because I think those are the films that are going to get,
You don't think it'll be Dinkins?
I would give it to Dinkins, hands down, just because I don't think, I don't know if, just judging from these awards so far, that True Grit's going to get much. I would give it to Dinkins, but, God, I'm really tempted to give it to Inception, though, just because, wow, that whole film is just so beautiful. But, you know, Dinkins' cinematography is always something to behold. Always.
Well, the big thing about Dinkins is that he's never won an Oscar, I don't think.
Well,
and he's one of those guys, you know, one of those modern legends.
Right, and it's what we said a couple years ago. No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, and The Assassination of Jesse James. They're just beautiful films on the surface. They just look, the landscape, everything. They're just beautiful.
Elswit shot There Will Be Blood.
I think so, yeah, I think.
Did he shoot Jesse James?
Oh, I don't know who shot this. I'd have to look that up. I don't know.
I'm not sure who shot that either.
But those are films that we talked about when they came out. It's just the cinematography was very beautiful, and I would love to see. If he's never won an Oscar, I'd love to see Deakins get it, because it is the one thing that I think everyone can agree on. It's a beautiful film.
You know, I saw an Elswit shot movie a couple of weeks ago. Finally, The Town, Ben Affleck's movie.
That's another really good film. I really love that movie. I'm just looking to see who the cinematographer was on Jesse James. Sorry, I mean
Ben Affleck is really good.
It's a really good film. He's a very good director. He's made two incredible crime films, and I really do think Hollywood Land's like that turning point for him. There's a humility in that performance, and I mean that in a good way. And it just
You go back farther. I mean, the turning point was probably Geely that allowed.
Well, that
this
Oh, Deakins shot Jesse James. Deakins did.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. But The Town is Town's incredible. I love The Town. I'm glad to see it's getting a lot of attention, because it's a very well done film.
You think it'll be up for Best Picture?
Well, we have 10 slots. I would like to see it there. I don't know though, because it's not. It is getting the Writers Guild nomination, so I don't know. I think it might get adapted screenplay, but I think adapted screenplay, I would think, belongs to The Social Network. That's just an incredible script.
Hey, I saw something the other night that might be of interest to everyone out there.
Okay, well, yeah, please. You know, it's your show, man. Go for it.
The Green Hornet.
What, is it good?
It's fine. It's fun.
Okay.
It's a movie. It's like a superhero movie made by people that you would normally never think would make a superhero movie. And so whatever whatever kind of zip it has is based on that. It's better than Mystery Men. But it's still like, it's a good entertaining time, but I mean, you're not overly enthusiastic when you walk out necessarily.
Right. Okay.
But it's uniquely done. And I really have never liked Seth Rogen more than in this movie. He's great in this movie.
Yeah, he seems perfect for him. There's something about the trailer that it seems very good. It seems like a lot of fun. But yeah, I mean, those are the best kind of movies. People who don't.
You'll notice too, like there's the actor that plays Cato in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really know how to speak English, so they taught him English phonetically with the dialogue and the script.
Right.
So he's a little difficult to understand. So you'll notice all the way through the movie, whenever a character's talking to Cato, they'll always repeat what he says as a question. He's like, I'm making this up. I'm going to the store. Is the line say. And the other character, because they know that you can't understand what Cato just said, the other character will say, the store? You know, and that happens like all the way through the movie.
Wow. Okay, I'll look out for.
it's a little discombobulating for the viewer, but
mm-hmm.
It has good action in it. Cameron Diaz is kind of perfunctory. I mean, she's not. You know, there's no real reason for her to be there except she's a name and they needed a girl.
Right.
But you know how this movie came about?
How did it come about?
The studio had been wanting to do a Green Hornet for a long, long time.
Yeah,
and
they've been talking about it for years.
They revved it up again, mm-hmm. and they contacted agents and they said, "Hey, have people come in and give us their concept." And
mm-hmm.
So Seth Rogen got a call from his agent, and he said, "Oh, okay, cool." So he went in and he pitched them his concept, and he won. So he and his writing partner put it together.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, so he wrote it. He co-wrote it, too. So.
All right.
It has some laughs in it. It's funny. And the 3D is like, why? It's completely, there's nothing that.
All right, well, I wasn't going to go see it in 3D. I just was going to go see it in 2D because I just really have no interest.
I didn't have a choice. So, but
they forced you. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I mean, it's a critic screening. It's playing in 3D, so you got to see it in 3D. But the it was why, except for extra income. I mean, that's the only reason why.
Okay. All right. Well, of course.
Because it does
nothing. They're going to milk that for as long as they can. I mean, all right. Do we've talked about cinematographer, director. I guess we want writers. Writers Guild?
No, let's ignore the writers, just like they do in Hollywood.
Okay. Now, there's some surprises in the...
No, let's do writers. Go ahead.
You have an original screenplay, Black Swan, The Fighter, Inception, The Kids Are All Right, and Please Give. Please Give being... That was caught me off guard. Adapted screenplay, you have 127 Hours, The Social Network, The Town, I Love You, Philip Morris.
Good, wow.
That's in there, and that's just... and you have adapted True Grit. I do think that's going to go to The Social Network. I just really don't see how you can't, you know, give that.
Have you seen I Love You, Philip Morris yet?
Yes, I have. Quite a movie. quite a performance of Jim Carrey. Great, Ewan McGregor, I mean, got a good year. The Ghost Rider and that, I mean, that's not bad. That's not a bad year for him. I mean, I think The Ghost Rider is one of his best performances, personally, since Trainspotting.
Me too. And you're seeing that ignored across the board.
Yeah, that is. I just don't see that. That was too early in the year. But I think Please Give is a surprise. I didn't expect to see that nominee. I like that. I didn't love it, though, but I did like it. You know, there's a lot of good. Let me see if I can. You know, there were two, and I know one of these films is you know, a lot of people hate, but the gentleman who lends Greenberg, Harris, what's his last name, Jamie?
Savides?
Yeah, he did Greenberg and Somewhere. Now,
right.
Somewhere is being just, you know,
nowhere.
Yeah, it. I mean, this is what I can say about it. It is magnificent B-roll of Entourage. That's what it kind of reminds me of. It's like the B-roll, like really incredible B-roll footage for Entourage.
That would have been a great title, like Magnificent B-roll.
Yeah.
That would be great.
Because that's what it feels like, really. But they're both very beautiful films, beautifully shot films of Los Angeles. I mean, this guy has a great eye for what makes Los Angeles this unique view of L.A., and he's just like his work on Margot at the Wedding and Zodiac. I mean, just in Birth. I mean, just incredible work.
Are you saying that he was nominated for cinematography?
No, he wasn't. He's nowhere to be seen. And I didn't think he would get. But those are. I mean, I was wondering. I was like, yeah. His work this year. He made two films. And regardless of what you may think about the films, it's just beautiful though.
Yeah.
But that's
well, that's
me.
That's one of those movies that had big award hopes. Months ago when it was announced as a December release somewhere.
Yeah, and it just...
And it didn't go anywhere.
It went, as you say, nowhere. I mean, so much that people were just really sort of... some people gave it a good review, and then others just tore it apart, and other people said she needs to leave her comfort zone.
Which is
what? Thompson in IndieWire said that on the Thompson Hollywood.
What is her comfort zone?
She's dealing... loneliness. I mean, all four films, in one sense, are really about loneliness. And a lot of people say she's really... I mean, it's really funny. I think she was writing a vampire thing before this, before, like, the whole Twilight thing blew up and everything. She was writing a vampire script, and then that, you know, she figured that would be overkill, so she went back to something else that she's more, I guess, familiar with. But I would love to have seen her take on a vampire movie.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. Was that what Marie Antoinette ultimately was about?
What, loneliness or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vampires. Loneliness.
Oh, no. it is about loneliness. I mean, her character, I mean, she obviously, Kirsten Dunst is obviously her alter ego, and it would have been very interesting. I hope that they'll work together again one day because they're both very comfortable with each other. But Marie Antoinette is really just about Sophia Coppola growing up in high Hollywood royalty, essentially. That's really what Marie Antoinette is about, regardless of the Antonia Fraser biography that she claims it's based on. It's really about Sophia. More than
reminds me
account.
Of the Armand White review of Somewhere. That says that that almost takes off the same place that that Ann Thompson article does, and that he says basically we're tired of seeing all your bitching and whining about your privileged childhood, and every single real problems.
Well, there is some he's not the first, she's not the first to say that. A lot of people have been saying that. Armand White, didn't he make a scene the other night?
Yes, we're going to talk about that after our first interview segment. After our first interview segment, Dean, we'll bring you on to talk to us, to join the roundtable. We got a caller on 732 area code. Let me see if this caller wants to talk a little bit. 732, are you there?
Hey, it's Will Kuiper.
Will?
Hey.
Hey. Happy New Year, brother.
Good. Happy New Year. I just wanted to listen to your show. What are you guys doing for the blog talk charging people from now on?
What are we doing?
Yeah,
are they going to do that?
Continue.
Are they going to start doing that?
They are going to.
Yeah,
I actually paid for the Four Horsemen. I decided to pay the premium for the Four Horsemen. So,
Is that what you're talking about?
That's exactly what he's talking. I think that's what he's talking about. That's almost a lot of ripples. I just gave in and did it for one of the. I didn't do it for the other show, but I did it for the Four Horsemen. I decided to. It was worth it. Well, no, you can still do a show, but here's the thing: it's gonna you do it a half hour. You'll get a half hour, but now having said you get a half hour, if you go over, that's fine. That will be played in the archives. But you won't be able to do anything like in the prime time hours. You can do, you know, one show a day.
Oh, wow.
You can upload three audio files. That's it. It's not bad, because especially for the solo podcast I do, that's not live. I don't mean to do that live anyway, so that I have no problem with that.
You do your own show on BTR?
Who? Me?
No, I don't. I just know a lot of people that do, and I just was wondering. Was working, and I knew you guys' show was successful, so I wonder if it was grandfathered in. No, there's a lot of people who do little shows here and there, and I also wanted to listen into the show, and I was working on, and I always hit one, which puts you into host queue, and so I came up with a question quickly.
Okay.
Sure. You got a question? Go ahead.
No, my question was just...
you're our first caller of our
new
show. So you have and you're just like my idol. So I mean,
I just wanted to crash the show. Now I want to hear. I saw Jerry put his little post up on Facebook.
On Facial Book.
Yes, I wanted to crash you guys again. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm good, man.
I always seem to make you guys nervous.
No, you don't make me nervous.
No, we're fine. Let me ask you this. What's your favorite movie of last year?
Mine?
Yeah.
The Taint. Have you seen The Taint?
No, I haven't.
The Taint?
Why haven't you told me about this?
It's a great indie film. It's a very trauma-esque film. Look it up. Something like thetaintmovie.com or something. Or just Google The Taint.
Okay.
But one of the few. 2010 was a horrible year, so...
For horror movies or for...
Horror movies. I've been paying attention so much to horror movies, this is what I have to do. And it was maybe the worst year since I've started my horror website. But it actually was the worst year. But The Taint is a great... It's trauma in 2010. It's a great film. Very... it's about...
Don't tell me.
Well, you know what? A lot of people ask me when I say The Taint, they say, is that what the title means? And it does. But it's a very good, if you like trauma or any kind of very independent, kind of spirited movie like trauma's films, then you definitely want to say The Taint. So it's my goal in 2011 to talk about The Taint.
Okay. Well, is that like the trauma version of The Human Centipede, by any chance?
See, I didn't see The Human Centipede.
You know,
I haven't seen that.
I haven't seen it either, but I'm telling you, The Human Centipede, I don't think is... If you like trauma films, it's perfect. It's a great... It's a Reanimator. It's Machete. I'm tired of the Fox kind of, bullshit, independent... fake, now we're going to make this kind of stuff. Someone made one of those films in 2010, so
I like
kind of movies.
Awesome.
Well, I appreciate
you calling
in.
Man. Happy New Year, man. Thank you for calling in.
Bye.
Thank you, buddy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, from The Taint to Barney's Version. Let me tell you about Barney's Version. This is a great movie. It's Paul Giamatti, Dustin Hoffman, Rosamund Pike. It's a great cast. It's a great sweeping story, 40 years in the life of this main character and those loved ones that surround him. You feel like when you've watched this movie that you've seen a whole life kind of unfold. It's one of those very fulfilling movies, and it'll probably make my top 10 list on Sunday. So look out for
okay.
it. It is.
I'll look out for it.
Going to be released limited this Friday, and we had a chance to speak to the co-star of the film, Rosamund Pike, who's, you know, she's done some stunning work in other films like
mm-hmm.
An Education. She was in the Bond movie. Which Bond movie was she in?
Die Another Day.
Die Another Day. That's what I thought. And also the writer-director, Richard J. Lewis, who comes from CSI, actually.
Oh, cool.
And this is a huge movie for him, and he does such an incredible job with it. A very tricky, delicate material. And it's a beautiful film, and I highly recommend everyone go out there and check it out. But here is Rosamund and Richard Lewis talking about the film.
That's for you. I even signed it. You screwed over everyone you ever knew or cared about. Now the whole world's gonna know what a murderer you really are. You could use a mint.
Mother.
How do you even know it's yours?
Well, I'm the father. And you must be an albino. A well-bred woman makes a nice like Yakubu, has a beautiful rack. Many successful marriages have been built on far less.
Did it come to you through the normal channels, this project?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent. I'd worked with producer Robert Lantos before, and he thought there might be, you know, that I should audition for Clara, the role of Clara, the first wife. And he put the book in my hands, and we'd worked together before, and I'd read it, you know, then. This is a wonderful novel, humorous and kind of picaresque and just great characters. And then when I auditioned, the director came to see the play I was doing in London with Judi Dench, and he said, you know, I think this girl might be a Miriam.
Mm.
And so I sort of put down my take on Miriam on a tape and sent it to them, and then they decided that they should get Paul and I together and see if that worked, and it really did, you know. And I think Paul really had my corner. He said he'd followed my work, which was incredibly flattering and surprising. And he said he knew exactly who I was, you know, which is always, you know, when one of your heroes says they know your work, you know, that's a great feeling, isn't it? A comedian I met said that he was, you know, he was just starting out. He'd hardly done anything, and he was walking through the lobby of a hotel, and Steve Martin walked by. And Steve Martin stopped, turned around, came up to him and said, I know who you are. I know what you're doing. Keep doing it. Right? I mean, that was such an amazing thing. Because he thought, you know, no one's seeing my shows. He was quite despondent, you know. And that was wonderful, wasn't it? So when somebody you've admired knows who you are, it's and knows your, you know, through your work, it's great, rather than sort of reading about your life, I suppose. But yeah.
So tell me about being engaged in a scene with Mr. Giamatti. What is that like for you?
Well, on one level, it's terribly simple. You know, it's very, we work in very similar ways. So, you know, I believed in him so totally as Barney, and I believed that I was Miriam, and it was just kind of, you know, we'd spent quite a lot of time together by the time we came to do most of those scenes, and, you know, we'd done the audition together, we'd done a week of rehearsal, which was incredibly helpful.
Hmm.
So we'd found a sort of physical language, and it's a combination of the character plus them, you know, and I kind of, you know, I was mad about him. I just felt like I knew him. I don't know why. You suddenly have a connection with someone, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So on one level, it was literally just keeping it simple and not sort of overdoing anything, not sort of pushing anything too hard, really.
Yeah. Rehearsal is so rare.
Rehearsal is rare.
In film. So what did that process give you that week?
It gave us a sort of physical ease with one another. It gave us intimacy. Because, you know, when you're training, you're doing a love affair, you know, that's what you need. And intimacy isn't about touching one another, as people always think. You know, intimacy is about the ability to look someone straight in the eye. Mm. You know, intimacy is not flinching from someone's gaze, and intimacy is seeing through to the soul. You know, and everyone thinks they can convey intimacy by doing some sort of cheap sex scene. And it's usually very rarely is it intimate, and even more rarely is it sexy, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah. And what do you think the movie says about relationships and kind of the notion of true love?
I think it says that it's founded on trust, and trust is the most precious thing in a relationship. And once it's broken, it's very rare that you can go back.
Mm.
You know, there is no. It's not black and white. You know, trust is either there or not there. That's the thing that I really took away from it. You know, Miriam can tolerate Barney's drinking, Barney's late nights. She can tolerate so much, but it's trust that, you know, in the end, he betrays her trust, and that's it.
Yeah.
She'll always love him. She'll always love him. You know, she's devastated.
When you've been at screenings with audiences with this film or talked to people about it, do people question why he would betray her trust in that manner? Is it just the idea that he's terrified to be alone?
Yeah, I think he's just lost his way a bit. He's started putting, you know, it's like the me first thing. You know, he's become a bit of a baby, and he's felt poor me and me first, you know? So he's sort of, and that's made him so sort of self-centered at that point that he's forgotten to sort of look at who he's really dealing with. You know, he's taken Miriam's decision to go to New York. He hasn't even thought about why she wanted to go to New York to spend a bit of time with their son. You know, he's all he's taken on himself is the indignation that he's being abandoned. You know, he hasn't thought of it from her perspective, and I think that's usually when things go wrong, is people become very one-sided and self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's when they can justify. So I'm sure he was able to justify his misdemeanor because he was able to say that, you know, she's abandoned me. Poor me.
Mm.
I'm so, you know, I've been left, you know?
Yeah. Well, the more you talk about it, the more I realize how much I really do relate to Barney.
Well, I think a lot of people do. You know, I think, you know, these are lessons. It's just Miriam is a very unusually, you know, I mean, Christ, you know, I was saying to Paul at that time, the scene that we did where, you know, she's done her radio interview and he has missed it because he's watching the hockey, and he comes back drunk. And she says, okay, I just wanted to be sure that we were clear on what happened here. You know, that you missed my first interview because you were drunk and watching the hockey game. And I said, my God, Paul, don't you wish that certain things in your own life had gone with as much dignity as Miriam must have in this situation?
So I guess let me start out by just asking how this project, I know that you read the book when it came out, I believe, in 1998. So first of all, how did the book speak to you?
I read this character that was, really sort of a well-drawn, intimate, flawed universal type character, and then I, you know, kept reading the book, and it's like the scenarios and the outrageousness of the character kept jumping at me. I mean, the notion of a guy who leaves his second wedding and to chase the love of his life in the middle of the wedding ceremony, I thought was a great hook for a movie. But ultimately, it was the idea that to study a man's life over the span of 40 years, three wives, two continents. I thought he was sort of, Barney Kofsky was sort of tailor-made for the cinema.
Mm-hmm. And so you, was the screenplay, because this was a sweeping story, was the screenplay hard to cement down and into capturing the essence of the book?
It was, and then when I did my drafts, which were prior to Michael Conavy's drafts, I was able to somehow crystallize the story down to the essential love story, the three wives, and the relationship with the father. And I kind of sort of had a little more of the murder that we ended up, in my drafts than what we ended up with. But, it was really hard to do that. And ultimately, I wish that there was the movie was in two parts. And there was another 2 hours, because there's so much, there's still more good material.
Well, that's what I'm curious about, because you got a screenplay you were happy with. But in editing, which is, they always say, is the final rewrite, was there kind of a lot of restructuring going on, or was that needed?
Yes and no. I mean, I think that there's, for the most part, the structure is what was designed. But we did have to eliminate chunks of, and some departures, some digressions that were quite delicious, to be frank with you, James. We were able to rationalize that by saying, it sort of drives the story more, and we're more with the story emotionally. This digression feels too much like maybe the wrong movie, maybe more of a, there were times where I fell in love with scenes, but, and this always happens in a movie, where you fall in love with scenes that ultimately do not serve the health of the overall film,
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with casting actors like Minnie Driver and Scott Speedman and Giamatti and Dustin Hoffman and Rosamund is that, you're absolutely you're going to have scenes that are fantastic that you want to keep in the movie, but really there's going to be too many of those scenes, and I think that's what we face.
Mm-hmm. And this is such a great performance by Giamatti. It's one of the best male performances I've seen in a long time. So I wanted to ask you about obviously directing him, as well as Mr. Hoffman, who obviously is a legend himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's quite an honor to work with these kinds of actors. It's like, they're thoroughbreds. They're the best thoroughbreds. They're essentially actors that you do not have to shape too much. In fact, a lot of my job in this case was trying to make sure that they had an arena by which they could really explore with each other. And that's part of, a lot of people think that good direction is controlling actors, but I think it's more like relinquishing control in some ways, and that you have to sort of my job is to clear a space for the great work and the moment to exist, for that serendipity to actually be able to occur, so that when they connect, and especially when you get two actors like Giamatti and Hoffman, they completely respect each other, and they come to work with this curiosity and this kind of playfulness and this focus, where they're looking to unravel the puzzle of the scene as it occurs. You know what I'm saying? So if you clear a space for that to happen, then you're doing your job as a director. Far be it for me to tell Dustin Hoffman how to act. I mean, not what I'm paid to do.
Yeah, but there's such a lovely warmth between them in that film. So I would imagine that they had that for one another, you know, naturally between themselves.
Yeah,
that kind of translated.
I think they did, and I think that good film actors really are able to translate what's happening in real life and use that in their performances. And in fact, they'll never steer away from anything that feels real. I mean, this is Hoffman's method approach, and there's certainly some of the Meisner technique in this as well, in the idea that whatever's happening in real life can be translated and used for the performance itself.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering your take on what the film has to say about relationships and the notion of true love.
Oh, that's heavy, man. What does the film have to say about relationships? Well, I mean, it certainly proves that it exists. A lot of people are skeptics in this day and age about true love and whether it actually is possible and whether we're just, searching for some ideal. And that nobody's happy, and how do you find happiness? All those questions are asked by people these days, and I mean, I'm here to tell you that true love does exist, because not only have I seen it in the movies, I've actually experienced it in real life. I'm lucky enough to be one of those ones that found Miriam. But I think also. I think it also has to say that, there's messages about sabotaging that which we love, and be careful what you wish for. And the whole idea of us being our own worst enemy, and getting out of the way of our own, demonic and monstrous impulses to destroy that which we love.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that is director Richard J. Lewis and actress Rosamund Pike. Their movie is Barney's Version, which opens Friday in New York and L.A.
That sounds fascinating. Those are good interviews. This is really I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, I love this movie. We'll be talking about it a lot more in future episodes.
Okay, cool.
Speaking of episodes, Armand White had one. Last night, we're going to talk about that. Hey, Dean.
Hey. Of course. Dude, what was that beep, man?
I love catching him off guard.
You did, too. How's it going, guys?
It's going good. How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. I'm in Scott's here in my place in Atlanta, finally, and I can get good radio reception, good phone reception, and everything. Unfortunately, my internet is out at the moment because we're all ice.
Yeah, I was looking for you in the chat room, so I was.
The ice down here is there's something going on with that.
So anyway. It's snowing in 49 states. Guess the state where it's not snowing.
Texas.
Florida, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was snowing there too. The way everyone was going.
No, that's the apocalypse right there.
Oh, God.
Starts snowing here.
Yeah.
I've never seen snow.
Really? You're lying.
No. I've never seen anything. I've seen
after
it on TV.
Last year, I've had enough snow. So I'm happy that so far we've only gotten these two or three dustings. I really could live without it right now.
I'm all right with it, and I fell down in it today. I went out going to the grocery store within walking distance, and
dude, you gotta be careful, man. Be careful out there.
Well, I did pretty good. I made it all the way back, and then 30 feet from my front door, I fell. So be careful, man.
I fell on my back when we had that ice storm in '99. We had that huge ice storm here, and oh god, I slipped and fell on my back. It was awful.
I realized as soon as we brought you on, Dean, we started talking about real old person topics. The weather,
falling.
Yeah,
we gotta stop that, because me and Dean are the senior citizens on the show.
Yeah. All right, sorry, I was distracted. Okay, so what's the old person thing? What are you talking about?
I said as soon as we brought you on, we started talking about old person.
Speaking of old people, let's talk about Armand White.
I do want to hear about this Armand White thing because I have an Armand White story myself.
Oh my God! Okay, let's do it.
All right, Armand White. We talk about him a lot here on the show. We had him on a couple of years ago. He is a critic for the New York Press. He is the what would you call it? President of the New York Film Critics?
I think that's
chairman.
Chairman, president,
yeah. Of the whole New York Film Critics Society?
Yes.
I'm not sure. He's
the chairman. That's what it says here. He has been the chairman for years. This is his last year. Part of the chairman's duty.
Why?
Part of the chairman's duty is to kind of host their annual award show, which he did last night in stunning fashion. So I guess it started. where do I find this here?
This is going to be good.
Oh yeah.
Darren Aronofsky went up to accept the award. No, he wasn't accepting the award. He was presenting the award to his cinematographer, Matthew Libatek, for Black Swan.
Yay.
Armand White did a review of Black Swan. He coupled it. He usually, when he criticizes a movie, he does so in service of praising another that he feels does something similar or better.
What was the Black Swan movie that he thought was better?
I believe it was a... Let me see.
The Mighty Ducks.
Was it Staying Alive? Staying Alive, wasn't it?
No. Kanye West video.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Kanye. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I thought it was Marmaduke the rate he's going. But I mean,
yeah. So he compared it unfavorably to a music video. So he goes up there. Darren Aronofsky goes up there, and he looks at Armand White and says, "Keep it up. Because you give us all another reason not to read the New York Press." The audience gasped and chuckled, and he said, "Hey, my only chance to have revenge against this guy, and now it's done. I'm sorry." But backstage, Darren Aronofsky said, that was a real bad move on my part. It's just, you pour your whole life into a project and then have it decimated like that hurts. So when Armand came up after Aronofsky made his comments, he said, "That's all right. Darren reads me. That's all I want. And because he reads me, he knows the truth."
Oh, my God.
Later in the evening, Armand introduced Michelle Williams, who was going to be presenting an award to Mark Ruffalo. He mentioned that he liked Ruffalo in 2007's Reservation Road and then complimented Michelle Williams for an even older credit, 2004's Land of Plenty. It seemed like a deliberate snub of her current role in Blue Valentine, which she panned.
Oh, God.
So Williams took the stage and said, "Thanks, that was like 10 years ago. I'm not going to read any of your reviews of my other work because you really had to reach." The final word...
Good for her.
The final word from Armand... I mean, this is in front of cameras and the crowds. This is on stage where he's making these comments. Best Picture, the final award, went to Social Network, another film that Armand White vehemently disliked. Mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't do like a best of the year countdown. He does like a list that's called Better Than. So
right.
He'll always say, basically this year he said everything is better than Social Network. So he goes up there, he's introducing Tony Kushner, who is going to give the award to Social Network. He says, "Surely Kushner, whose great play Angels in America showed how spiritual and social connections transformed lust and envy to family, friends, and country, has a moral responsibility to explain why The Social Network is good."
Jesus Christ.
Okay.
God bless her, by the way. I like it.
Well, that was enough, right?
And then the evening closed, and he took his final swipe when he said, "I thank the Circle for not awarding a single award to Greenberg."
He really hates Noah Baumbach with a passion. I don't know why, but...
Yeah.
Armand White's
like the guy in Arizona who I don't want to name anymore. Let's not give him any more press.
I think when I put my review up of Greenberg on Filmicability, Matthew Zoller's site directed Armand White to my review, and he read it, and it, I guess he wasn't impressed by it, but or it didn't change his mind. My thing is real short. At the New York Film Festival, my little Armand White story is really short. At the New York Film Festival, on the bottom, you know, it goes up into, like, stadium seating, but there's that bottom row, you know. That,
right.
You know. And I guess Armand White has a specific seat that he likes to watch movies in. So so when we were waiting for a particular movie to start, there was this big commotion that was going on. You know, it's a quiet room, you know, everybody's just sort of chattering very quietly. And then there's this big commotion going on over on the floor, and it's Armand White giving shit to some guy for sitting in his seat. It's like, how are you supposed to know this is Armand White's seat? You know, it's a theater. It's a movie theater. It's not blocked off. There's no seats blocked off. But this guy, Armand White was standing up over this guy, and this guy was sitting in his seat, and Armand White was telling him, no, fuck no, get out. He was cursing, too. And he's like, no, shit, no, this is my seat. Get out.
What a gentleman.
I was like, wow.
Can we please have the Glenn Kenny Armand White, you know, face off on our show? Can we please have that? I'm in Glenn's corner, totally. I mean,
well, when we had him on for De Palma, I had to call him to get him on.
Yeah, I know.
And so I called him, and I knew he was. He's been working on this De Palma book forever, and so he said, "Oh, he was asking questions before he'd agree to it." And he said, "Who else is on?
Yeah.
Who else is on?" And I told him, and one of them was an author, the guy that called us from Israel. That,
oh, yeah.
God, I can't imagine how expensive that phone call was. But he was, he said, oh, have you read it? And I said, yeah. I said, it doesn't get published for a couple of months, but they sent me the PDF. And he said, oh, can you send it to me? And I said, no.
Yeah, good for you, man. Don't.
And there was this long pause, and he was like, all right, I'll do it. So.
Oh well, at least he still did the show.
It was
enlightening, to say the least.
He was very smart. He's very smart about.
Oh, he's a bright guy. He's just,
he is, and his writing is good and everything. But I just don't understand his reasoning. He never makes his reasoning very clear.
And he comes across as very bitter. And I know you're not supposed to really say that, but that's the first thing. He's just so bitter.
But about what? You can't even figure out about what, you know.
But
like,
you get that the tone reading some of these things, and it's like, you just want to say, please, enough.
I just can't figure. I guess when I read his things, they're just like performance art to me. It's not anything else but performance art. It just feels like you know, acting out to get attention or something.
Wants to be our villain. That's what he wants to be, the villain. He enjoys being, you know, maybe he really is a De Palma fan. He is the bad guy. He wants to be the bad guy.
Huh. That's an interesting take on it. I think there's something to that. I do. So.
Yeah.
But he gets what he wants. We're talking about him. So.
Yeah. I mean, we're giving him, you know, free press. So.
The DGA nominations for documentaries, Outstanding Directorial Achievement for Documentaries. Lixin Fan for Last Train Home. Lixin Fan. Wow, that's quite a name. That's
that
a
is.
Cool name.
That's a Chinese name, right?
Yeah, let's say it is.
Charles Ferguson. It's a movie about Chinese. Okay, sorry.
Charles Ferguson for Inside Job and... Mr. Ferguson will be on during our Oscar week on Movie Geeks.
Oh, cool.
Alex Gibney for Client 9.
I still haven't seen that. I still have not seen it.
I wasn't crazy about it. Davis Guggenheim for Waiting for Superman.
Okay, I saw that.
And Tim Hetherington and Sebastian Younger for Restrepo.
I just saw that a couple weeks ago. That was good. But my favorite documentary is not on there of the year.
The Taint?
Yeah, The Taint is not on there. So, no, Exit to the Gift Shop. That would be my favorite documentary of the year.
I wonder if they maybe have left that out because of the whole, like, is it a documentary, is it not a documentary thing?
I don't know, because isn't it on some other nominations and other awards, though, for documentary? I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, did it get a Spirit nomination, or?
I haven't seen it at any of the writers, or because the Writers Guild also does writing for documentaries as well, and it's not on their list or on the DGA. So I'm wondering if something like that in Catfish and
Catfish. I was shocked wasn't on here. That was
I watched Catfish,
but that's another thing.
Yeah.
That's another thing. I mean, we're seeing this upward trend of documentaries that you question the authenticity of you know,
mm-hmm.
what they're trying to do.
You're right. I think that's more true. See, I was thinking that more true with Catfish than Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yeah, but they're both kind of in that same thing,
right.
You know, that like that, and you know, I'm Still Here, obviously, which we know is not a documentary.
I have that on. I got that from Netflix. I got to watch that still.
But I think it's just the signaling of a kind of a new genre, really, which is a kind of a mixture of documentary and
narrative.
And narrative filmmaking. I think it's a.
Yeah.
I don't even think we can call these mockumentaries. I think we have to come up with a new word
right.
for them because I don't. I think it's just a new way of telling a story.
Right.
So. But
they pretty much depend upon your absolute belief that what you're seeing is real, like that it is a documentary.
Mm-hmm. Do you?
Yeah, they do.
Think that this new genre that we're talking about. Is in the wake of the last decade of reality-based television?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure. I think it's the filmic effect of those shows.
Mm-hmm.
It's also kind of the filmic effect of everybody having cameras, you know?
We all. I mean,
yeah.
Like,
everybody
I have an iPhone
has
that
now.
Has a camera
yeah.
on it. I mean, yeah, I mean, everybody has it. You're absolutely right. Don't do anything stupid in public. That's all I can tell you. You will be filmed.
Yeah.
All right. 7 nominees have advanced in the race for the Best Makeup Oscar. So this is a category that they kind of solidify into a core group, and from that they pick their 5 nominees.
Okay.
So 2 of these will not make the cut. Guess which ones won't make it. I think one is fairly easy. Alice in Wonderland. Barney's mm-hmm. Version, The Fighter, Jonah Hex, True Grit, The Way Back, and The Wolfman.
Huh. Wow.
There have been some absolute duds. three, actually, but Alice in Wonderland will get nominated because it's the highest grossing film of the year, isn't it? Or one of the highest.
It'll get in there, and then the Wolfman will get in there, and then there'll be one other weird one, like Barney's Version. That'll get in there. Because what is that, old age makeup?
Yeah.
Okay. What, The Fighter, though? They're giving The Fighter?
What about... Yeah, that's unusual. That's
that
really
is unusual. I mean, it's a great movie and everything, but the makeup wasn't the thing that really...
Well,
God, that's great makeup.
That's awesome makeup on Melissa Leo.
The eyeshadow was just piercing.
But you know what was pretty good in that movie, what they might be nominating for that movie is the hairstyling, because the hairstyling is part of the makeup award.
But I don't,
too.
You have to give some
credit to the hairstyling of those sisters. You
oh,
know,
God,
crazy,
yeah, the sisters from hell, yeah.
Yeah, well, the crazy hairstyling.
Yeah, no, no, you're right. But no, I'm not making light of the makeup. That's very important because one of my good friends, Christine Wasilewski, does makeup for a lot of independent films around here, and she does a bang-up job. So it's not like there's a lot of work goes into it, even for, like, the non-like special effects films, obviously, a lot of work
right.
goes into it.
Yeah, I think you guys got it right. Alice in Wonderland, Barney's Version, and The Wolfman will get nominated. And I'm sure Alice in Wonderland will probably win. I don't know.
Black Swan didn't make that cut?
Alice in Wonderland
really?
Makes me sad. No, it did not.
That's surprising. I'm surprised about that. Okay.
I am, too, because of the stage makeup and the other stuff. You
yeah,
know,
yeah,
fun.
The other stuff, yes. The yeah. other stuff, definitely.
But, okay. Well, those will be the three nominees.
You know who else is in The Green Hornet is Edward Furlong.
Oh,
wow.
Awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
He hasn't been doing anything for a long time. For a little while, I thought he was dead. I thought he got along with Brad Renfro.
That's cold-blooded, man. That's just cold. Great. I was talking about Brad Renfro the other day, explaining to people who he was.
God, we're at the point now where we have to explain who Brad Renfro was. Like, people, we're of such an older generation that we have to explain it to the younger generation.
Well, the lay people, they don't know, man.
I guess. Somebody that was popular when he was to us,
yeah.
when he was 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
We have to, that's just
right.
discouraging, man.
Yeah, it is discouraging.
Hey,
but his
speaking
death
of
is
which,
overshadowed by Heath Ledger's death too. So,
right. I hate it when that happens. Speaking of which, Peter Fonda found a dead body.
Wait, when did this happen?
I don't know. Hang on. Let me look
your
it up.
Computer froze up, right?
This is all tied in together, man. It's a perfect segue.
He was robbed of an Oscar for Yuli's Gold. Okay.
It's coming up. Hang on. I'm pulling it from TMZ. Peter Fonda.
TMZ is what we're going to. Oh, great.
Yeah. Found a dead body, the body of a man who committed suicide. Sources tell TMZ Fonda was driving on Sunset Boulevard at around 2 p.m. when he saw a car parked on the side of the road. Fonda got out of his car to check out the situation and found the body of a man slumped over in the front seat. Apparently, this man was not an easy rider.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
That was my own joke. I mean, no, that was a great joke.
All right, awesome, folks. Yeah. You're not going to get that anywhere else.
No. Okay. Also, you guys hear about this mini series, The Kennedys?
Yeah. They're showing it in Canada,
yeah.
though. The Canadians
could see it. So are they not showing it here?
It's not. And the History Channel nixed it.
Yeah, so the History Channel paid for this thing. It's a miniseries of the Kennedys. Greg Kinnear plays JFK and Katie Holmes plays Jackie O. And, you know, we talked about this when it was first announced.
Yeah, we did. That's right, we did.
All the liberals were getting onto it, like, why are they making that? Because apparently it's very...
It's a conservative hit job on
yeah,
the Kennedys.
It's critical of the Kennedys. Which, you know, it's hard not to be.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, it's not the first time that this is...
I mean, it's hard not to be critical of, like, in the modern day and age of any kind of dynasty that's replete with this kind of
yeah.
conspiracies and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Anyway, but we were like, you know, they should go ahead. I mean, I thought that liberals should, like, stop complaining. There has to be a conservative movie sometime. I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
not like
yeah.
they own movies. But History Channel doesn't want it, apparently, after they paid for it, you know?
Wow.
So
well,
so
I mean,
they shopped it around everywhere else. Everywhere else has turned them down. FX, Showtime
FX turned
them down today.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, Showtime turned them down today, and that was, like, one of their last saviors that they thought they could get.
Everyone has been critical of the Kennedy,
well,
liberal
just a
and
bad
conservative.
Movie. Well, maybe it's just a bad thing. Maybe it's just bad. Like, maybe it just has nothing to do with the fact that, oh, well, they pay attention to all the bad things that the Kennedys did. Maybe it's just a bad movie.
Well, everybody else is saying something different. I mean, even Showtime, I thought it was a funny statement because they said, this is a terrifically made project that's extremely well acted. It just doesn't fit our network. And I was like, yeah, because it's a great project that's terrifically well acted, it doesn't fit your network. Yeah, so they didn't necessarily give a decent excuse.
Right.
But I would think it's probably going to go on demand.
That's awesome. Wow. But I don't understand, what is in it that is so inflammatory that hasn't been said before?
Well,
nobody's saying.
Well, you know, they're going to have, it's going to be like the full, you know, it's all the stuff about the private life.
But we've seen variations of that.
We haven't really seen it.
And we've been reading about it for years. Countless.
We know that now. Frank Sinatra, Nancy Sinatra, admitted that the mob helped get Frank Sinatra elected in certain states. Frank Sinatra helped him with his connections, the mafia connections, helped get the Kennedy elected in I think in Chicago and things like that. They help.
Yeah.
This is coming out now. We know about the Marilyn Monroe thing. We know about all this stuff. It's not like, how should I say, not taboo. Sadly, it's common knowledge. You know, I don't understand what is so shocking in this thing that would either cause them not to show it. I'm just really curious.
Well, one thing that that the Democrats do have over the Republicans is that we're a little bit more artistic, and we're a little bit better at making jokes, making movies and things like that. So it's like
I know exactly what you're saying, because the stuff that does come out, that does make it through on the right wing side, is just, you know, their criticism, how there's a bent. Their thing is just as bent on the right, to the right, though, and but poorly made. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you see something like, you know, and I've watched them, things like, you know, Michael Moore Hates America, that documentary, and things like that. They're just not. Let's just face it. They're just not as good. They're not. They're not anywhere near as good. It has nothing to do with the fact that what they're saying is, you know, goes against my political beliefs.
Right.
I'd be more than welcome to entertained, you know, their, you know, the political beliefs are aside, you know, I look at the movie itself, and the movies aren't that good. So it's like, so I'm wondering if this is falling into that same category. You know, maybe it is.
You liberal heathen.
I know, but I mean, I'm sorry. Part of the reason I am liberal is because we do know how to craft a good joke and a good movie and a good television show or a good record
or
whatever.
That should be your campaign. Vote for me. I can craft a better TV show than the other guy.
Yeah.
Now, wasn't the guy who created 24 one of the producers of this?
Yes.
Okay. That surprises me. He doesn't have that kind of clout that he could. I'm really curious what's in this that no one wants to air. I'm really curious.
What is the best TV series made into a movie?
Best TV series made into a movie. Well, it'd be The Fugitive, right?
What about the Addams Family movie? I like those. Those are fine. What about Star Trek? The first couple Star Trek movies. Well, not the first one, but Star Trek 2, obviously. But
that's one. That's one that I would put in there. I would also put in the Brady Bunch movie. I thought that was a pretty funny take on that whole thing.
No, the way they approached that was a good. That was the only way you could make that.
What about Car 54? Where are you?
Dude, I have that on Blu-ray. It's one of my all-time favorite films.
On Blu-ray?
On Blu-ray. I have a Blu-ray, especially like from Japan, an import. No, I'm joking. Jesus Christ.
Japanese import.
Special commentary from, what's the guy?
From the only person that has ever seen it.
I've never seen it, though. I don't know. I have that. I also have Mikhail's Navy and Sergeant Bilko, too. All awful. Why would you even think that those would work? They were great for the show.
Like
awesome for their time. Awesome
the box
for their
set.
Time.
Are there any others? Are there any others that, you know, have hit?
I'm waiting for the Happy Days movie. That's what I'm waiting for, in the Laverne and Shirley movie. So those I will go see.
I guess there was the Kids in the Hall movie that wasn't really a...
Well, that South Park. The South Park movie was great.
Oh, yeah, that
and
was
the I like the Simpsons movie. I mean, that was good.
I didn't even pay attention to that Simpsons movie. Was that even worth seeing?
Oh, yeah, you should check it out. I mean, you can rent it on Netflix. It's fun. I mean, I don't know if it's... you know, I don't. It is kind of like an extended episode. There's no...
You guys are missing something.
Well, tell me, what am I missing? The X-Files?
How about the Naked Gun?
That would take the cake. That's the all that you're right. That's the best.
I would say that show actually works better as a 30-minute series, to tell you the truth. I mean, like that, you know.
And they show some respect for the dead, man.
Oh dear God!
I laugh like
you cannot believe, like all 90 minutes of.
Oh yeah, all
the first
of
movie
them.
Especially.
I thought were hilarious, but the first one, that opening scene in the first one, that's great.
I haven't revisited those movies in a long time. So.
Because you're O.J. Simpson phobia, right?
I could watch The Naked Gun, and then right after The Naked Gun, put on Shoah. I would still be laughing. That's how funny I think.
I thought you were going to say Antichrist, but okay.
At least until you fell asleep from having Shoah on.
Segue, Jamie. I like Shoah. That's interesting, Shoah. And I think at dinner I almost tonight said, I'm just sick and tired of films about the Holocaust. Oh, God.
Yeah.
I really am, actually. I just really have really gotten to the point where I just think it's, I don't know. Never mind. I'm sorry to bring that up. Sorry. I'll shut up now.
No, I'm sure it's something that we're going to continue to see. I mean, I think that every generation needs its own kind of defining Holocaust movie to just keep it.
But don't you think, see, this is, in all seriousness, this is something that really, I guess, in the late 90s, just working in the bookstore for a couple of years, and there's so many books about the Holocaust, and then there's so many movies, but it's an industry. There's something, I don't know, it's an industry, obviously.
Yeah.
But I do think the last couple of movies that have come out, I just think you trivialize it. You know, obviously, it does need to be, I understand, it should be always kept in the public eye, but I think sometimes we trivialize it. And when we make too many movies, it just becomes, you trivialize it. It's unavoidable. You just, I don't know,
well,
it's just
know,
the
when,
thing I wrestle with every year.
You know, when Stanley Kubrick was going to make The Aryan Papers or Wartime Lies.
Wartime Lies, I couldn't wait for him to make that. Uma Thurman was going to play the main character. And
well, actually, it was going to be a Swedish, they did test with this Swedish actress, the woman who played the woman who vanished in The Vanishing, you know.
Oh,
in
that would have been interesting, too.
So some of that footage still survives, and actually some performance artists or installation artists took some of that footage and made a sort of artistic installation. I read about this in Film Comment around the test footage done for Wartime Lies with this actress. Anyway, Kubrick abandoned that project because he didn't feel that he could live with the horror of it for so many years, and also didn't feel that the world was ready for a movie that really showed the true horror of it like he would prefer to do, and so he just abandoned it. But I think that that's what people are, until we get a movie that really shows the real horror of it. And yeah, you can put Schindler's List in, but
I would put Europa in that.
Well, you can put in whatever movie.
No, but Europa,
whatever movie you like.
Europa is probably my favorite movie. I mean, not my favorite, it's a word, but I think one of the best films made about the Holocaust. It really gets to the, there's a scene in there that just gets it right. That really just gets the whole view of the German and Jewish, the relationship between the German and the Jews, just perfectly. And
well, that's one of the great movies of the 90s. But what I'm saying, Jerry, is that nobody, they're not going to give up on doing Holocaust movies until someone gets it right, like gets it as horrible as it could possibly be.
Well,
so they're going to keep making them.
Oh God. Well,
there's some things that you just can't.
I don't see how you then. Oh, God, Dean. I mean, having. You're right. The Kubrick one would have been. Probably would have been that film, but it's. I don't think then you're going to get that, because I think the farther we're removed from it.
You know, the ultimate Holocaust movie that could be made and should be made but won't be made because the author won't give his permission to make it into a movie would be
Eli
an
Wiesel.
Animated No, it'd be an animated version of Art Spiegelman's Mouse.
Yeah.
An animated version of it. Just do it total black and white animation. Use everything that he had in his books as storyboard art, and just animate that thing. And that would be probably the ultimate. That would be the way to still do the ultimate Holocaust movie without actually sickening people. Because it's actual, you know, real people.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying?
I understand that. That would be interesting to do, and I'm surprised no one's done it yet.
Well, he's been approached as for movie ideas, but he doesn't want to sell the rights. So.
Mm-hmm.
Has to be a level of responsibility when you tackle a topic like the Holocaust. And I don't know why so many Holocaust movies have been made, actually, because it's not like people will flock to them. As a business decision, it's not a movie that people will go to be happy, you know?
Yeah,
it's,
no, they're, to be you're entertained. Right. I mean, they're...
Well, when you look at the whole history of movies, let's look at, I mean, like...
Oh, Jesus, we're not going to look at the whole history of movies,
are we?
No,
not going to do the Holocaust tonight.
But really, the first Holocaust movie that had ever been done, besides, you know, one-time footage of the actual liberation of the camps, the first one that really was done was probably Judgment at Nuremberg, and that was 61. That was almost 20 years after the liberation of the camps. So,
what about the shop around the corner? Or what was it, the shop on the corner?
Well, shop around the corner was later on. That was like in the mid-60s.
The pawnbroker?
But
the pawnbroker deals.
The pawnbroker was there almost the first.
But You've Got Mail.
That was, yeah, that's the one that I was, yeah. I mean, that really, I mean, I
but,
grew up during
what,
that movie.
I guess what I'm saying is that I don't really feel that there has been a plethora of Holocaust movies. I feel that there's a lot more to be said about it.
Well, then they have to take, then they really, I mean, I'm really curious about if you, I'm just trying to think, how would you, I mean, Schindler's List is pretty close to, that. There are scenes in Schindler's List of the horror of it. You could also say that about The Gray Zone.
And we're missing the documentaries, too, which are
yeah,
perhaps the most
really
valuable.
Are really the most, and Jamie's absolutely right, the documentaries really are the most valuable things here.
Yeah,
and we're reaching a period where the survivors are dying off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're not going to have. I mean, obviously, we're going to have the bloodline, the children and the descendants
yeah.
of the survivors. But the survivors themselves, for the most part, are no longer with us. So the value of a Holocaust movie, I think, would be in telling those personal stories of the survivors and their journeys.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we're going to have that after a while, you know. Of course, they can do recollections based on written
right,
books,
right.
that kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's what makes the making of so many documentaries important. I think that's why the rush to do so many documentaries has been done, is because, you know, the survivors aren't going to be around forever. So.
Yeah.
But
that's like, this is a happy discussion, guys. Hey.
Yeah, I'm really just like, please just punch that we're having this discussion. I mean,
let's play our next interview. It's a brief interview. Katie Azleton, she is an actress, the star of a new movie called The Freebie. She's also the writer and director of it. It's a romantic kind of comedy drama
mm-hmm.
co-starring Dax Shepard. The premise is that a married couple that feel a little, they obviously have a great love for one another, but their relationship feels a little stale in terms of intimacy. They kind of make a pact or some kind of, it's almost like a dare, that they each can have a freebie where they can go to another partner for one experience and come back and tell each other about it. Maybe it'll pump up the excitement in their relationship. And, of course, you can imagine what kind of consequences that has. And the movie is now available on DVD, and it came out yesterday. And here is Katie to tell us all about it.
It has been a little while since... I haven't done it since the calendar year started. We're not...
Oh, my God. Not great.
Hypothetically.
Hypothetically.
What if we were both comfortable? with each other having a one-night stand?
I just really want you guys to pay attention to my husband right now and watch him stutter and backtrack.
Look, I'm saying if you came to me in a time machine and said, hey, P.S., you're about to meet Annie, I would have maybe done everything shy of paying for it just to make sure I got it all out of my system.
Do you realize I'm sitting right here? I can hear you.
I do. I come every
day.
Yeah, but you still come in to see me, right?
Maybe being with one person for the rest of your life isn't natural at all.
It means that for tonight, you are not.
Maybe if we're out there in the world and with other people, we're reminded of everything that we had when we started.
I'm married, yeah.
That's your wife. Mm-hmm. So why are you here? I have no game anymore.
Sweetie.
I barely had game when I met you.
Sweetie, you have a major game.
So explain this to me. Explain to me the process of putting this movie together. You came up with a 6-page outline?
Yeah. I mean, it was really, I'm a frustrated actor, you know? And so it came from me wanting an acting gig and being married to an incredible do-it-yourself filmmaker who wouldn't mm-hmm. let me sit on the couch and mope and complain anymore, you know? So he was like, why don't you just do something? And so finally I did. I came up with this idea that it was like the one idea that had come to me up to that point that I could see from start to finish. And from there, I approached it really as an actor. It's the only way I know how to approach it. I've never done anything before. So the idea that was really exciting to me was to do this collaboration with really talented people. I had met Ben Gasulki, my DP, at a film festival the fall before we did this, and I had also met Nat Sanders at the same film festival and loved their work. Nat Sanders was my editor. I really loved their work, and I had this idea sort of going back to the Cassavetes way of filmmaking, which is just all getting just like-minded people together who all can agree on how to tell a story and then getting together and telling that story. And I think with a story that was as simple as The Freebie was, which is really just sort of examining this couple and this relationship, I thought it would be really fun to just find an actor that you could do that with and not give them all the meat of the story, just give them the guidelines and sort of let the moments happen as they will and see if we can make a movie out of it.
So what we're watching on screen is largely improvised.
It is all improvised.
Okay.
It was, yeah, it was just a 6-page outline. It was really, the dialogue was Dax and I just talking.
So I understand you did a lot of very long takes to try to find what the essence of each scene was. How did you know when you had it? How did you know when it was working?
Well, really, the one scene that we did that the most with was the bedroom scene where we sort of conceived the idea of the freebie. And I think that was when I was sort of conceptualizing the movie, that was the biggest hurdle, I think, was to make that very believable for the audience, to make those characters very likable going into that. And so I really wanted to be careful to make those moments and those conversations that would pop up be very honest and simple and relatable to the audience. And so, you know, we would go through and talk. We talked that shooting of that scene took maybe 8 hours of us just lying in bed and having this conversation sort of over and over and over again and letting it go you know, to all lengths and all reaches of where that conversation could go, and then really finding what we connected to the most. And truthfully, I mean, you ask when did I know, but when you're in a conversation with someone and you can feel the honesty and the truth, and when I would feel that sort of in the moment with Dax, and I know he would feel it too, and he would talk about it afterwards, would look around to the other people in the room and say, what do you think? Did we get it? Did we not get it? And that was sort of, that was how we did it.
So when you, because you called yourself a frustrated actor, and so you needed to get this project off the ground to kind of challenge yourself in a new way, when you're directing actors, do you find that you're directing them as you yourself likes to be
directed?
Yeah,
you know, I like it to be a collaboration. I like to be appreciated for what I can bring to a table. And I always say it's, I like giving actors, and I like when I am given creative responsibility in a project. I think that's really exciting. And that's when you, as an actor, I think can feel truly invested, is when you're being appreciated on that level.
Did it feel schizophrenic at all?
Really didn't, I have to say, because I trusted everyone who was on board with me. They were my safety net, and I didn't. So when, you know, we would start our days with these long, long conversations about what the scenes were that we were going to shoot and what we needed to get and what it needed to be. And so when we were ready to shoot, I felt very comfortable, you know, walking around and just being the actor. And then, you know, when that had, you know, when we were done with that scene of coming back around and saying, okay, what else do we need to get? What did we miss? Did, you know, do you want to take it again? Kind of thing. It was very natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm interested to know the audience reaction to this. Did you premiere this at Sundance?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It was interesting, and Dax is actually a funny one to talk to about this, because he was at the premiere screening at Sundance, and he had seen it a number of times when we had done test screenings in Los Angeles. And he had always felt like, yeah, you know, it's a 50-50 thing. And, you know, they both go into it willingly, talking about the characters. And then, for some reason, that premiere screening at Sundance was very sided towards my character. They all were sort of rooting for Annie and really villainized Dax's character, Darren. And it was really funny. He was like, I thought I was going to get stoned walking out of the theater. He thought, he was like, the way people reacted, people were very vocal. They were like, no, he didn't call her that. No, he didn't do, you know, talking back at the screen. It was really energized and exciting. And then, you know, we screened again at South by Southwest, and it was totally different. Then Annie in Austin was, you know, my character was a total slut, and they, no one can believe that she did it. And I have to say, like, screening it for different audiences, we're always getting different reactions.
Mm.
It's cool. I called it sort of, it reminded me of those books when we were little, those Choose Your Own Ending books, because it really, it can have, depending on sort of the direction that the audience goes in when they're watching it, they all seem to go together, you know, and so it's a different experience every time. It always leads to great conversation, which I really, that is probably what I'm most proud of with this film, is I think that's a mark of a good movie, is when people are talking about it afterwards and discussing it and arguing over what actually happened. And I think that's really, I was incredibly proud.
I think so too. And what I was curious about is, and you seem to be saying it's not the case, is if it was kind of split down gender lines, like the women felt sympathetic towards
you.
You
know what I find? I find it split down the lines of where, of how people are in their own relationships. If they're feeling good and are very secure and happy, like, they feel one way about it. If they are on the rocks or going through something really awful, they feel another way about it. And that, those are the lines I've found sort of trended through my screenings.
Now, did you, because there seems to be a question, I listened to the commentary the other night, too, on it, and if I understand correctly, there seemed to have been a question as to whether or not they went through with it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you mean for that?
I mean, it is left, it's pretty ambiguous, not to be a spoiler, but it is, you know, And that was a choice to make it ambiguous. I like the idea that the audience is sort of left in their shoes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the best. That's the best that you can hope for, too. That an audience is left questioning and talking about your movie when they walk out of it. That's
yeah.
The dream right
although
there.
I mean, then there are the audience members who hate that kind of thing. You know, they're the audience members who get really pissed off and are like, "No, you need to answer the questions." But like, go see a Hollywood movie if that's what you want. They tie everything pretty.
Yeah, that's right. Do you have the directing bug now? Are you anxious to get back in the directing chair?
It's so weird. I kind of. I didn't for a while. I did right after we finished because I didn't want our shoot to end. I loved everyone that I was working with, and my crew was so fantastic and wonderful. We really, I mean, it's the most cliched thing you can say, but it's like we really became this tight-knit, very, very close family, and I didn't want that to end. Where I started getting sort of sour on the directing was post film festivals. You know, like, I love taking the film out to festivals. I love screening it. I hated sort of the marketing of a movie and having to sell it and worry that people are going to come to a theater, and the theatrical part of it and the distribution was sort of, it put me through the ringer and exhausted me a little bit. Because I feel like that's when it stops getting creative and starts getting very businessy. But now that is sort of in the rearview mirror, now I'm kind of excited again.
Okay. That is Katie Azleton. The movie is The Freebie. It is now available on DVD, so go pick it up.
All right.
It sounds good.
Yeah, man, that was a good interview. That was really cool.
Okay, before we close off tonight, we just got off episode 2 of the Kubrick series, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank everyone for thank you everyone for listening to it live. If you haven't heard it yet, it's available on replay, moviegeeksunited.net. So you guys' thoughts?
Well, I thought it was terrific.
I thought it was awesome. I mean, it was incredible.
I liked
it very well
too.
Put together. It was flawless.
What I liked about it was that it focused in mainly on, you know, the meaning of the film and less on the, you know, nuts and bolts of how it was made and more about the impact and the mystery of it. So
yeah.
I like that.
Why one person write I saw a comment from one person that they didn't understand it.
The show or the movie? I mean,
No, the movie.
Okay.
So I sent them the link to the show, and I said, this might help you understand it even less.
I always direct people just to watch the movie on the big screen. I always think that sort of helps kind of mm-hmm. clear some things up, at least. You know, watching it on television, no matter how big your screen is just not the way to watch it.
Right. No, you're right.
It's best, you know, projected on film right in front of you, you know, and it's best to get a good seat and just let it watch over you. And
as long as it's on Armand White's seat, and you'll be
yeah, really. Don't sit in his seat, Jesus.
You know, but there's no other director, seriously, that we can do this kind of treatment on.
No.
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah. And it's best to take the time with it and everything too.
So I mean, what other directors are there? I mean, because if you do which we have done, shows on other directors, it's always kind of limited to the experience of making each of those films. If we do a series of these shows, but no other director can kind of invite that level of interpretation and discussion on meaning and what made them so unique, like a Kubrick series mm-hmm. can. So it's like, where do we go?
Well, not that you could do this with every film that he made, but you know, I think a Cassavetes series would be interesting.
Like, yeah, that would definitely be I think worthwhile to pursue. I don't know, maybe for shit, I'm trying to think. Terrence Malick, maybe. Not a series like this, but maybe a one-time, one show, like 2-hour show, maybe about him.
Yeah,
And just in celebration of Tree of Life, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, our Kubrick series will probably still be running.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you're right about that. But
I fully expect the Kubrick series to be going for another 6 months or something like that, right?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you have those expectations. Yeah.
Just, you know, it gives you time to, like, do everything that needs to be done and stuff. But I just, you know.
So, Dean, have you seen any good movies in Atlanta real quick?
I've been watching a lot of movies, you know, in my place. So I've been, what did I watch? I watched Catfish, which I liked quite a bit. I was surprised how much I liked it. I watched Somewhere, which I was rather bored by.
I think that's the consensus with Somewhere, I think.
I just think those shots go on way too long. I'm sorry. And
how many pages is the actual script? I mean,
I don't know. It must be like 15 pages because
I mean, at the most. I mean,
yeah. It was a slight little. I didn't hate it, but
no, I don't hate it. But I mean, it is a slight film.
Yeah, it is. And then I watched White Material with Isabel Huppert from France.
And Tarzan. Tarzan was in it, too.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that was quite a film.
That was an interesting movie.
Chris Lambert.
That's what I thought.
Johnny Weissmuller was in it.
I mean, it is set in Africa, but Tarzan's not in it. let's see, what else did I watch? I think those are the major ones that I watched. Yeah.
I got the Broadcast News Criterion today.
Oh, you're lucky. I mean,
it's good. I've already watched the commentary and all the documentary stuff on it. It's very good.
Yeah.
It's my favorite Brooks movie. And then I got these Sam Fuller Criterion releases, The Naked Kiss.
Oh, those are all good. If you're done with it, I would love those. I would love it.
And Shock Corridor.
Naked Kiss and Shock Corridor, right?
Shock Corridor, yeah. And The Naked Kiss are great, yeah.
But Shock Corridor is the one Sam Fuller movie that I've seen. You know, I remember hearing a story about Sam Fuller. Rod Steiger told it. He thought Sam Fuller was a terrible director. And he said, before a take, Sam Fuller, to get some kind of energy, some kind of feeling of vitality, he would fire a gun.
His wife is very nice. I met his wife.
Steiger's wife?
Fuller's wife.
Oh, because we actually had
a friend of ours on Facebook. She's very nice.
Christopher Fuller.
Yeah, and I see you autographed his autobiography for me. I went to go see 40 Guns at LACMA one night, and she was there. And she's one of the nicest people in the world.
She's
a delight.
Really nice. She is really nice.
So, I mean, I'm just expressing Rod Steiger's view of him.
You got to watch some more Fuller movies. You know, you got to watch Fixed Bayonets and The Steel Helmet and
There's another one. There's one with Richard Widmark. What's the one with Richard Widmark?
Pick up on
Fuller Street's great. Pick up on and the big red one obviously is awesome.
Crimson Kimono is good.
Yeah, Shark with Burt Reynolds. I don't know if that's the one I'd really be boasting about, but
no. Or Dead Pigeon on Beethoven Street.
Oh yeah,
that one. That's no good.
Dead Pigeon on Beethoven Street.
That is a movie. That is a movie.
Yeah, don't
start making this stuff up.
It's not so good. No, those are real movies.
Okay.
But he's good. He's good. Watch his movies. His war movies are terrific, especially the ones from the 50s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's a fascinating. You don't have many people. There's a great documentary made about him back in the 90s.
What was that called? Tenebrae?
The Gun, the
like
Typewriter,
that?
Or something. The Gun, the Typewriter.
Oh, right.
I think Tim Robbins was a narrator.
I didn't see it, but
yeah. Oh, guys, been a long time since I watched it. So,
and then of course, didn't Jim Jarmusch go and take some footage of that Fuller had shot and try to go and finish it or something like that?
I think
like,
that, and also remember Sam Fuller is in The American Friend.
Yeah, and of course he's in Contempt as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Jean-Luc Godard.
He's all over.
You're
the place.
In Contempt.
And he's in 1941. He's one of the American commanders in 1941.
That's right. That's right, guys. Yeah, he was great. He was. You don't have anyone really. He was another. We could really do an awesome show. I mean, I'm not about him.
Peter Weir did The Last Wave, right?
Yeah, that's Peter Weir.
Okay, so Peter Weir did Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave. He was on the precipice of a big American filmmaking career because he had like a choice where he could go one way or stay his own path.
Mm-hmm.
Because Kubrick recommended him to the studio to direct a big screen version of Salem's Lot.
Mm.
Mm.
And he worked on that with a writing partner for a while, and he was just tearing his hair out, and then he decided, no, I can't do this.
And we're the better for it, because the movies he made, he's made some incredible films. I mean,
so they went to Toby Hooper. Yeah, so that's the Peter Weir Toby Hooper connection that you guys have all been dying to know.
Yeah, no. Yeah, Peter Weir's made just a lot of incredible films, though. I mean,
favorite Peter Weir film, Jerry?
Either The Picnic and Hanging Rock or The Last Wave. I mean, one of those two. I think Picnic and Hanging Rock is one of the scariest films I've ever seen.
For me, it would be somewhere between, it might be between Gallipoli and Fearless.
Well, I would have to also put The Year of Living Dangerously in there, too.
Yeah, I mean, he's done a lot of great stuff.
And Commander. I mean, don't forget, Master and Commander, I think, is a superb film.
No Witness?
A Witness is on there, too, man. I mean, there are a lot of great films. Look at all the films they're naming after the Salem's Lot thing. I mean,
even The Cars That Ate Paris is really good.
Wasn't that his first film? Isn't that his first?
Yeah. Well, that's his first theatrical movie. Then I don't know which came first, but he also did a thriller for television, for Australian television, that's also very good. It's on the Cars That Ate Paris disc as an extra feature, but it's the whole feature, and it's called The Plumber. It's about a woman that keeps calling the plumber to her house. She lives in this apartment building, and the plumber starts terrorizing her. Her husband doesn't believe her and all that kind of stuff, that the plumber is causing a lot of trouble, and it's really good. probably the most obscure Peter Weir movie.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to end the show tonight with.
We're going to end the show tonight.
Yeah. I have nowhere else to take the plumber. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Really, after that, really, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this show's going right down the drain at this point. So we're going to end tonight with a piece of movie score. From Alexander Splatt, it's really, Dean, you love this score. You've mentioned it before.
Yeah.
It's going to be nominated for sure.
I think
pretty sure, yeah. This is Alexander Splatt's... this is Alexander Splatt's theme for The King's Speech. If you miss any of it, you can pick it up on the archive, if this happens to cut off. And you can also catch Rosamund Pike's interview near the opening of the show as well on archive. Thank you, guys. We'll be back Sunday night with our top 10 of 10. And we have some great content coming up for you for the rest of the month as well. Jerry, right. Dean, thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, everyone. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Yeah.